From our studios in New York City and Miami, Florida, you are listening to The Striking Corner with Eric Rivera and Vinny Scotto.
This is another episode of the Striking Corner podcast, and I am your host, Eric Rivera. And as always, I am joined by my good friend, Vinny Scotto. What is going on, man?
Good.
Everything good?
Good.
All right, cool.
Yeah, so this is episode 94.
Uh-huh.
When the last episode released was 92.
What happened to 93, man?
I don't know. Went somewhere. Eric went into another one of his disappearing acts.
Yeah.
And decided not to release it.
Yeah.
So
it might be because it's a solo episode where it's just you and I.
Yeah, I don't think it was anything special. It wasn't really a good one, but
that wasn't the reason.
No, I wasn't mad about you not releasing it. It's just the fact that you kind of screwed up the schedule here and the order. So now this one's going to be released and people are going to hear this one. Then all of a sudden 93 is going to pop up out of nowhere. And
make this one 93 and that one 94.
it doesn't work. Well, it just wouldn't make sense. But anyway.
Yeah.
Hi.
All right. So before we get started, this episode is brought to you by Fight City Muay Thai and Fitness. That is at 7 Pitts Bay Road in Hamilton, Bermuda. The owners and coaches there are Chuck Morgan and Nikki Stout, who I actually was the other day at your gym, right? A couple weeks ago.
I don't know where your time frame is. Obviously, it's pretty screwed up.
Yeah, was this like a year ago?
it was like almost 2 months ago now.
Oh, shit. Anyway, my bad.
Yeah, Nikki came by before I went to Thailand. So. Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. That's just my way of...
Episode 93 went.
Exactly. Went down that rabbit hole. Anyway, Chuck Morgan and Nikki Stout are the coaches there. Programs are ring-tested Muay Thai. They specialize in transforming beginners into ring-ready athletes, Thai boxing, and Thai boxing for fitness and weight loss. Once again, guys, that's Fight City Muay Thai in Hamilton, Bermuda. And as always, thank you to Chuck Morgan and Nikki Stout for their continued support of the Striking Corner podcast. You know, doing big things there in Bermuda for the Muay Thai scene. All right, guys. So besides that, you can always find us on social media at Striking Corner on Instagram, Striking Corner on Twitter, and Striking Corner on Facebook. My personal Instagram is Eric Rivera_TSC. Vinny, how can they get in touch with you?
You can get in touch with me. I'm gonna change it up here a little bit because I got some other things going on. So yes, obviously Instagram at Vinny Scotto, but you can also find me on Facebook.
Oh, wow.
Which is Vinny Scotto. And the reason I'm giving out my Facebook is just because of just things going on. I mean, it's an easier, I prefer Facebook messages over like Instagram messages.
Okay.
And everything going on that I am now hosting a YDL, a Youth Development League in New York in October. So it's just easier for contact and stuff like that. So yeah, find me on Facebook if you have a kids program or a child that competes in Muay Thai. We have the first ever YDL that's going to be in New York on October 27th. And it is also the first ever Muay Thai that I know of anyway in Staten Island.
Damn, man, doing big things. So that is awesome. That is awesome. I going to try to make it out there. Won't make any promises because I promise shit and don't go through with it. So
yeah, good idea. Don't promise.
But I always like to make excuses to go to New York, and that is a good excuse. Anyway, so today, guys, we have a very special guest. All of our guests are special, but definitely a good friend of ours, somebody who's been really we've known for a long time in the sport and been involved in the sport for quite some time. Never had him on the podcast, though, but glad to finally have him now. It is none other than Rami. He's got so many nicknames. The son of Palestine Ibrahim. He's also known as the Cinderella Man, as the Arabian Nightmare at one point, I think it was. Anyway, Rami Ibrahim, guys, from Rami Elite in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Definitely a great guy, always to talk to. Tons of knowledge, tons of motivation. I know a lot of you guys that know him from the USMF or have been on Team USA or on the East Coast Muay Thai community know about Rami. But he's, for any of you new guys, he's definitely somebody that's awesome to speak with. So glad to have him on the podcast. We will be back with him in a few moments, and talk to you guys soon.
The Striking Corner.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Striking Corner podcast. My name is Eric Rivera, and as you guys know, as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we have none other than Rami Ibrahim, a good friend of ours from, man, go way back, really, with Rami. I saw him fight. I seen him come up, and now he's pretty much a big name when it comes to U.S. Muay Thai, obviously, with the USMF and everything and how he's helping out. Man, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, boys. It's a pleasure to be with you guys and talk to you guys yet again.
We're always chatting with Rami, either if we're at an event or Vinny's, up in New York with Rami. So, Rami, you're based in Philly, correct?
Yes, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, home of Rocky.
Yeah, man. So like I was saying, I've known you for quite a bit. I've seen you fight. You were fighting even before I knew you. Been fighting around. What do you always say? The longest or the
longest active fighter in North American history since 1992. Not some guy that did Muay Thai and stopped and retired and came back. Did kickboxing. No, since the early 90s, man, when people really thought Muay Thai was a Thai drink.
Yeah, definitely, man.
They still do, man.
So tell us a little bit, man, because I know, like I said, I know a lot of people maybe on the East Coast definitely know Rami. I know a lot of people on the West Coast do, too. But, we got a lot of new listeners and definitely a lot of people that are getting into the sport these days. Some young bucks and everything, young women and young men. Tell them a little bit about, how you got started in the game, man.
So my story has been on over the internet many times, but I'll be glad to share it yet again. In 1990, originally me and my family, we lived in Kuwait, and there's six boys. I'm the youngest of the six. The three older brothers were here in America studying, and then the three younger ones, me being the youngest of the three, went to go visit them in 1990, about a few days before the first Gulf War. So when we came to visit, my mom and my two older brothers came to visit my three older brothers. A few days later, the Gulf War started when Iraq invaded Kuwait. And then we lost everything. And we went from my father dealing with nothing but the king himself and the princes over there to living in a ghetto and having nothing. So life was rough. I didn't see it. I kind of felt a little bit, but my family tried not to show it to me, at least. And so because we lived in a very, really bad area in Philly, my family wanted to keep me off the street. So prior to that, I used to get into fights a lot with the kids in the street because of the fact that I was the odd one. I was the odd kid in the street and in the neighborhood. So everybody would always fight with me. And so my brothers got pissed and they were looking for a solution, and my oldest brother put me in one of my other brothers, they put me in a martial arts where I started my Muay Thai. But he said you'd have 6 months. After that 6 months, if anybody puts their hand on you and you don't break their hand, I'm gonna break your hand. So that was my motivation and drive to hurry up and learn how to fight.
Yeah,
and that's how I started.
So yeah, man. So how was How was the Muay Thai scene back in the day? I mean, where did you start? So you said you started in Philly, because I know you were in Sitan for many years in New York. Were you in New York ever, or was it always back and forth?
No, so I'll get to the New York, how that happened. But so Muay Thai, I'm pretty sure everybody knows Muay Thai is still not big, but compared to how it used to be, Muay Thai is huge now.
Yeah.
I started in the early 90s, and I don't know if you guys know about Vought. I'm sure you know Coban.
Yeah, of course.
But, Vought was the one that brought Muay Thai, you know, over here. And my trainer, my first trainer at least, he was the one that brought him to America. And we started the Muay Thai in that school that I was training at. And he then brought Coban, and that's how I... That was basically my introduction to Muay Thai through Vought and Coban. And my first trainer, Gregory Purifoy, who ran a school called Golden Fist in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So I started Muay Thai with them when they first brought it over. And I stayed with them from 1992 till 2000. In 2000, I became a part of Sitan Gym, training under Aziz Nabih. And it's funny, my last fight actually with my first school was against Aziz's fighter, Hisham.
Yeah.
And so that was my last fight for that first school and basically the beginning with my new school.
Yeah.
And people used to think that I lived in New York because I used to train in New York and I used to be seen in New York more than anything.
Yeah, yeah. You know
what I mean? And but I was just dedicated, man, and I had so much motivation. I really didn't know why, but I did. I used to go to school, and even when I started college, when I was 18 years old, I used to go to school Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and my schedule was like this. Monday, I would go to college. I would finish around 12 o'clock, and then I would take the China bus to Times Square, take the R train, get me to Queens, Astoria, and then I would train Monday night with Aziz, sleep over, train Tuesday morning, and then stay there and train Tuesday night, and then Tuesday night session after that's over, I take the R train back to Times Square, midnight, take the China bus back to Philadelphia, go back home, sleep, wake up more Wednesday morning, go to school, do it all over again.
Oh, shit. Yeah, man. Yeah, because like that's funny because I did always, I think even as long as I've known you, man, I did always think that you were, well, for a while, I always thought that you were based in New York. But then
people
I always.
People from Sitan Gym thought that.
Yeah.
I want a lot of people to hear that dedication put in.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so many people that are like, man, I got school, I got work. It's like, man,
I'm sure you
it can be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just stop acting like a bitch and do it.
If you want something, you're going to do whatever you want to get it. You know, yeah. I always tell everybody, you got to be hungry so you can eat. If you're not hungry, you're not going to eat. You know, you look at a homeless man, you know, you see them picking up the trash. You think they care. If you are hungry for something in life, no matter what, man, you're going to go and do whatever the hell you want. And vice versa. If you don't want something, no matter what, nothing can make you do it.
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. So, you know, going, so you've been actively, you were actively fighting at that time. You know, you said, like you were saying, you were with Sitan and everything, but then, when was it that you opened? Cause at first, when you started, your own gym, you were Sitan Philly, right?
Yes. So when I opened up my gym, I was the Sitan Gym Philadelphia branch.
Gotcha. And about what time was that? When was that?
2007. So, 2007. I was only 23 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's when.
Yeah. So did you? And then when did you transfer over? Because I know now. I mean, obviously, the name of the gym, Rami Elite. When was it that you transferred over to becoming Rami Elite?
2014. Oh, May okay. of 2014.
So it's been all right. So you were like 7 years Sitan, and then moved to. Was it because you moved? Did you move the actual gym, or what was the?
No. So from 2007 to 2014, I'm guessing what like 8 years mm-hmm. As a Sitan gym owner, and then we had a falling out. Me and Aziz, things weren't going at the time. Things happened, and I just leave it at that. And me and him you know, had a conflict, and I felt like it wasn't working out for us. So I ended up leaving the name Sitan Gym, and I changed my name from Sitan Gym to Rami Elite.
Gotcha. And so now that you're Rami Elite and everything, obviously I've always enjoyed reading your posts and everything over the years, because I know you've, like you said, you know, if there's anything, one thing that I know about you is that you're hungry, you're a determined guy, you're a confident guy. So man, like one of the things that I always see is that, you know, you would make it a point of always saying, you know, not only, you know, 'cause I think for a lot of gym owners, that's a rough thing, is that you run the gym, you teach, but at the same time, man, you're bringing up fighters, you're training fighters. But I remember it was a lot of times where you were like with your phone running and telling people, you know, it's right now, it's like, you know, it's, I don't know how many degrees below zero, I'm running right now, I'm training for a fight. You know, I got my cousin holding pads for me, 'cause nobody else can hold pads for me. And that's how I got to do it. You know, I'm a fighter that has, I don't have a coach, you know, and so it's like everything you had to do, you did it in a lot of ways, you're doing it the hard way, you know, but it's really amazing to see, because that dedication is kind of shows through. And then it also shows through in your fighters kind of get it, because you're leading by example in a lot of ways.
It's, I know it's amazing hearing it, but every time I look at it, man, like a part of me wants to cry. You know, I look at it like it's a sad thing to me. Like, you know, I feel like, I achieved more than I ever would have dreamed of. I achieved more than people now doing. But even still, I feel like if I was given a fair deal, like, you know, I had my trainer, I had in the gym, I didn't have to go through hell and back to get training. I feel like I could have moved mountains, you know, like. I used to, you know, I have over 30 plus fighters. Everybody knows I got a lot of fighters, right? And I'm never selfish towards them. I always give them the attention over myself. And after I'm done, I close the gym. Like, I'd be training at, you know, I'd be seen doing live at 1-2 o'clock in the morning. I'm training in the gym by myself with the bags, or going running in a snowstorm. And then that was like, I'm like, listen, okay, if I'm not getting my training, one thing I'm going to make sure that I'm making myself go through hell. You know, it's just the psychological level. And that's what I'm trying to give to my fighters. You know what I mean? Like, my experience, you know, and that is, it's just like this saying goes, fighting is 90% mental. Like, no matter how much you know, physically it doesn't mean nothing. It's here. You got to be mentally strong.
Yeah.
You know, because if you're not mentally not strong, it doesn't matter how much you know, it doesn't matter how much cardio you do, you know, how physically strong you are, it doesn't matter. You got to be strong here. You know, I say to my fighters, there's two hearts. You know, it's kind of wrong, but it's like, you got heart here and you can show heart here. You have to be, people can show their courage not only through their heart, but also in the mindset. You know, like, there's fighters, I'm pretty sure both of you know, mm-hmm. they have a lot, they have heart, but they break down. Mm-hmm. Because it's a psychological thing. They break down psychologically, and that's where they lack the courage, mm-hmm. you know. And I try to tell them, you know, like, so many times you guys see me go through hell, but I still went through with the fights. Why? Because it's a mind over matter thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I tried to show to not only my fighters, but any fighter that was watching and reading my post.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure there's a lot of fighters out there that don't have it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not what you have. It's what you do with what you have. You could have the best freaking trainer. If you're not mentally strong and you're not hungry and you're not disciplined, don't mean nothing.
Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the things that I want to say, always wanted to ask you, or I think a lot of people ask you, because I look at you, man, you're an inspiring dude in a lot of ways. You know, I've always looked at you that way. You know, like, every time I would see you, I'd say, what's up to Rami? You inspire me in a lot of ways, because you gotta, it's your attitude. You're like, there's something about you. And I always wonder, what's behind the drive, man? Like, what's behind the drive for you? Why are you so motivated?
If I told you I had a I'm sure the answer, I would kind of be lying to you, but I would tell you it's a number of things that brought me here. Like, you know, there's people that say, oh, this was my dream. I never really had a dream about being a fighter. I really never had a dream about fighting as long as I have, or winning all that I have. I was like, even like 15 years in, I still really didn't know why, like my purpose, but I started understanding that there's something behind me fighting. And I believe that is why God, the creator, you know, had it destined for me to be a fighter. And that was not really so much for me, not to be successful for myself, but to help other people succeed. And to help, what I mean by that, by just helping my fighters, you know, for example, like everybody knows, like the whole world knows, I speak about Palestine and people that are being oppressed and this and that. I feel like that is my real cause. Like me being a fighter is just a platform to use. It's just like, you know, a comedian, he uses all his, you know, the sadness that happens in their life.
Yeah.
As a way of, you know, so I feel like that was my way. And not a lot of people know about this, man, but I was kidnapped at the age of 4. Mm-hmm. In Kuwait, Palestinian kids used to always be kidnapped. A lot of the kids would be kidnapped to be sold on a black market and to, you know, to do God knows what. You know, you could use your imagination.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, I was meant to be a fighter from the beginning, you know, and what I mean by that is just to not give up, you know, to be strong, not physically, but more so mentally, spiritually, and to use my downfalls to help other people's growing up in life.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if you want to go more into that, but I mean, how did you get out of that situation? I mean,
getting kidnapped?
Yeah.
I was only 4 years old. Yeah. I was only 4 years old, and I remember it like it was yesterday. So my mom and my dad, I was with them, and it was just me and all of my brothers, and we were going to drop off, to pick up my dad's shirts from the laundry. And when he parked like facing the storefront of the window. Uh-huh. And we were like only a matter of a couple of feet. So I kept bugging him to let me go down with him. He didn't. He went down out of the car, and then my mom put the sun visor down, and she was like, I guess, putting her makeup or fixing herself or whatever, and then kept bugging her, and she let me go because we were so close to the door.
Yeah.
So when she saw me walk to the door, she thought I went in. I kept knocking on the door. My dad didn't open, and I was just playing around. He didn't pay attention. He didn't see that I was at the door. So then I look over, and I see these two, obviously bigger men than me, and I'm looking up, and then they're wearing the long over white garment. I don't know if you ever seen like Middle Eastern men, they were long ago. So like that. And I still remember, man, I looked at them and I smiled and kind of laughed. I thought they were just playing around. They picked me up and they started running. And then my mom, I guess she saw, she came out, she started screaming. But then by the time my dad got, she got to my dad and my dad got in the car, they were gone. I was gone in the van and we were gone. And next thing I remember, it was the same day. It was at night. It was nighttime. Through the windows, you could see it was nighttime, and I was in a big rug factory, like towards the end of it. Mm-hmm. And all I remember was they were about to make a sale for me to sell me. Mm-hmm. And then right before like I was taken, my dad came in with, like, because he was the manager of the Kuwaiti airport, so he had a lot of connection to the police and mm-hmm. and so forth.
Yeah.
So they came in, they stormed in, and then everybody started getting beat up, locked up, and my dad started walking away. I remember my dad walking away as all that stuff was happening.
Oh, shit.
We were walking away with me.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Damn, man.
Yeah.
So you remember it. I mean, I had to be a traumatic experience, because if you were 4 and you still remember that, you know, definitely that's a traumatic thing. And like you were saying, like, there's so many things that you've dealt with, because you've dealt with that. Then you dealt obviously with the, I mean, how old were you when you guys picked up and left because of, well, I mean, you didn't leave because of the Gulf War, or were you visiting?
Forced. We were kind of forced. So we came here to America, to Philadelphia, to visit my 3 older brothers.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then, like a week later, the war started, and we lost everything. Like anybody that was in Kuwait, if you weren't Kuwaiti, you lost everything.
Yeah, of course. You know?
And we were kind of forced, like, this became our home now.
Yeah.
So we had to start from scratch.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And then you're like, you know, you were talked about the, you know, growing up in Philly and, you know, you guys were sort of in the ghetto and you were out of sort of the odds out, because I mean, how many people from, let's say, the Arab community were at that time in Philly? Were there many when you were kind of?
There was a good amount, not a lot like it is now, but there was a good amount, and a lot of them were Palestinian.
Yeah,
but they were also coming up, you know. Everybody was kind of like, all the Palestinians that were here, like they were also on the come up, like they were trying to build their lives.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. All right. So, I mean, the one thing, so we already talked about your motivation. I mean, a lot of it comes from personal, you know, things that you've dealt with, and you kind of just push yourself to go forward and forward. It's kind of strange because it's not strange, but I think that happens a lot with a lot of fighters, that you kind of ask them, I guess, I mean, you said that you didn't get in it to fight. You were kind of like, you know, you were picked on in a little bit, and then your brothers are like, no, we're going to fight, and, you know, we're going to put this kid in Muay Thai, and if you don't, you know, if the next time you guys fight, you don't beat the crap out of the guy, then we're going to beat the crap out of you. So that was sort of a motivation. But, you know, I want to go back to that, because Vinny and I always kind of ask the question to people, is like, when you started Muay Thai, did you know you were going to fight? Did you know you were going to compete? And you said no. You know, you said that wasn't something that was on your mind, which it always strikes me, because, like, I don't think it's funny. A lot of our fighters that we ask, we always ask them, you know, did you come into the sport with the idea that you were going to fight? And they're like, you know what? Not really. You know, I just started training and getting into it, and little by little, they kind of got into it. And I think a lot of us, there's always that joke that to be a fighter, you got to have like a screw loose, you know, you got to be a little bit messed up. There's got to be something wrong with you to continue doing this. You know, I remember I would get in the ring and I would say, dude, why the hell am I doing this? You know, why am I doing that? Why am I standing across? And you know me, man, you saw me fight up when I was in Take On and stuff. Like I was a heavyweight. So I would look at the guy across from me and he's like this massive dude. And I'm like, why am I going to fight this guy right now? Why am I doing this? But then the bell rang and, you know, you just go with it. And there was, like, afterwards, man, the adrenaline rush, you know, the love of the sport, it was like, God, I love this, you know? But, you know, so what was it that for you, you know, like, you said you don't really know, but I mean, did you obviously love the sport, you know, and we'll talk about that a little bit with the USMF and everything you do with them, but, you know, what is it that drove you to continue fighting?
So first off, before I can answer that question, I'm pretty sure you guys could agree with this, but I'm a gym owner, but I've seen that everybody that came to me saying they want to be a fighter did not become a fighter.
Yeah, exactly.
Either they never started, or they started and took a fight and never did, they realized this shit is not for them.
Yeah.
You know? And the ones that come in and they're like, yeah, I want to try it out, those are the ones. Because they, you know, because like, the ones that come in expecting to be a fighter, they think things are sweet.
Yeah, so yeah.
You know, in their minds, they're already like, I don't want to be a fighter, you know?
Yeah.
They don't know what they don't.
My man, you don't know shit about what you're going to go through.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't understand what it takes to be
like,
a fighter.
Like you said, you got to be crazy. You got to be a little cuckoo to do this, you know?
they see all the fame and the glory on TV, and they think that's what it's all about. Yeah, but they don't realize how much work needs to be put in.
Yeah.
To answer the question, in 1996, I had a fight in a Holiday Inn in Bucks County, Philadelphia. And I was fighting a kid. And mind you, my family never told me about what it is to be a Palestinian. Meaning, like, they never told us about the conflict we have back home.
Yeah.
You know, like the war and stuff, you know, and with Israel and Palestine. So I never knew any of that stuff, because my family just wanted me to learn American culture, and they didn't want me to have anything to deal with being Muslim, Arab, Palestine. They were worried, you know, so they wanted me to just become an American boy and not have any of that problems behind me. So, 96, I had a fight with this kid who was like a Jewish kid, but didn't mean nothing to me. You know what I mean?
He's just another kid.
He's just another athlete. We're competing. So, that week, the Israeli prime minister was assassinated, and they at that time, when it happened, they thought it was a Palestinian that did it. But obviously, as you look into research now, they later on found out that it was one of their own assassins.
It was Itzhak Rabin? Was this? No.
Not Rabin. I forgot the name.
Yeah.
It was in 96, whoever the prime minister was.
Yeah.
So because of the assassination, they had an Israeli event at that Holiday Inn. So when they found out that this kid, they knew he was fighting, and they wanted to come watch him. And when they saw me, I was coming in on my back. I wore a robe that had a Palestinian flag, an American flag, and a Thailand flag. That was the robe I always wore.
Yeah.
So when they saw that and they saw that I won, all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
I was only like 13 years old.
Yeah.
All hell broke loose, and they started throwing chairs at me. They started throwing sodas at me. It was so bad, they had to bring like police and security to escort me out.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't even walk out of get out the ring. So I thought it was just because they were mad that I won. I didn't think it was anything other than that. And then I'm like, I'm home. I'm like, I'm sat with my dad. My dad, like, I'm like really sad. Like, I'm crying. And I'm like telling him, why did they do this to me? Why were they so angry at me? Well, what did I do? I didn't win by cheating. He's like, that's not what it is. I'm like, what is it? And that's when my dad just sat me down. And he grabbed my hand and he's like, he said, it's because you're Palestinian.
Yeah.
And I, he said, it's because you're Palestinian. And I said, what does that mean? And that's when he started telling me about what happens back home to the people living in Palestine.
Yeah.
And that's when I started doing my research, and I began to follow this thing called political activism, you know, and then I started becoming, without even knowing it, I started becoming a political activist, and I started going to protest, and I started understanding or realizing that I could use my platform as a fighter to fight in different ways. You know, I can't go back home, you know, and fight their fight, but what I could do is spread knowledge and be a voice for the voiceless, you know. And then in that sense, that was a motivation. And I tried so hard not to stop fighting, like many, many, many years, like from 92 to 2008, I never retired. And I could have stopped a long time ago, you know, but I felt like I cannot stop to continue using my publicity, me being in the public eye, to try to help people who do not get help, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a big, major part of why I continued fighting for as long as I have.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it goes back again. Like, that's the thing that's a continual story with you, is that you've dealt with quite a bit of adversity and different things shaping your kind of a revolving around fighting, shaping the reason why you would continue to fight. Because at 13, for that to happen and you not really know what was the story behind everything, like you said, you know, you were kind of living this life as, you know, we just want you to be an American kid. And then there's like this whole backstory to where you're from and, you know, and where you come from and why certain things are happening or why certain people look at you the way they do. That's obviously, like I said, it's a lot of big things, and I would say either traumatic things or rough things or sad things, and then some things that could be uplifting as well that got you to this point. And you know, and it's great because as I've met you, like I said, over the years, it's really cool to see how your fighters, you know, your fighters and people that know you fucking love you, you know, they adore you. A lot of people that we've, you know, heard about, obviously, you know, if we go into the USMF conversation, we talk to a lot of people about from the USMF, and they're always like, you know, we had that big round table when we were at TBAs, right? And we had all these guys, and they were like, oh man, Rami's missing. Cause he's like the cheerleader number one for this team. Like, they were talking about how you like go crazy and, you know, you just start, you know, yelling and screaming and chanting and, you know, Team USA and everything. You're kind of like in a lot of ways, almost like a spiritual leader for the team. So, I mean, it's crazy, you know, like you bring a lot of positivity and people love that. And, you know, one thing, and it's funny, Rami, you don't know this, but one of the things that always stands out to me about you is, I think it was at a take-on many years ago, I don't think you were fighting for that one, but remember that back in that time, Eddie would sometimes bring me in to shoot stuff or shoot pictures or stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And I would do the flyers for Takeon and stuff. So I remember I shot like a little sort of a video promo. And then I've talked to some of your fighters before, but at this time I remember it was because you were sitting down, and I think it was with, at that time, you know, you were still with Seton, and I think you sat down with Jessica Nen, right?
Yeah.
And you were wrapping her hands, and you were getting ready for the fight, and then everybody tells me that you kind of have this whole speech about how, and I always remember it because you were telling her like how what we do is a privilege, and what we do that we're fighting is, and I think you're smiling already because you know that speech, because what we do is a privilege, and basically in Thailand they don't have that where they can just choose to fight because they love it. It's kind of like they have to do it, you know, they live their life by that. But in this case, you know, we can do it for fun. And you were kind of telling her like, you know, this
I
is
say that to every single fighter.
Yeah, exactly. So tell us a little bit about that, you know, about that mindset, because I think it's really important. I mean, I think always that speech is like a big deal, man.
It's a huge deal, man. It's so, you know, the people that we look up to, you know, our students look up to, and people in the Muay Thai look up to as superstars, you know, back in Thailand. If they only knew how those superstars are living and how hard it is, you know, they do this. They're forced to kind of do it originally. You know, their family just go and sell them, literally.
Yeah.
And they are, like, I remember, you know, when I went to Sitsong Pinong in 2011, at the end of my trip, I wanted to take the fighters, the young ones, the older ones, all of them out for a night out. And I had to ask permission. I thought it was just a matter of, okay, let's go out, take these fighters out. Yeah. I had to ask permission of the owner of the gym.
Yeah.
If they are allowed to leave the gym.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, these are, I'm not talking about regular fighters. I'm talking about like Sirichai.
Yeah. The big names,
I had to ask permission to take them out, you know, Abhishek and all of them, you know, to take them out. And
yeah.
It's not like, you know, like going, you know, to another country, like only like 10, 15 minutes away.
Yeah.
To the movies, to the arcade and stuff like that. And I had to ask permission. This is what their life is like. Yeah. I remember another incident. I went to go give Sirichai money. He didn't even look at the money. He didn't even count how much I gave him. A lot of money. He didn't even count it. He just took it and gave it to his mom.
Oh, shit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because that's,
you know,
what,
when I mean, they, when they win, that money goes to the gym, to the parents, and a little bit goes to them.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is how it is. And then over here, you come back home to the States. We do this for a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, like, no matter what you say about how hard your life is, your life, you're like a king and a queen compared to other people in life doing this.
Yeah.
You know? And this is really, truly a luxury. Like, if you are able to go and buy any shirt you want to fight in, you got it good.
Yeah. True. Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Your last name is not the name of your gym, you know? And that's what I try to tell them, man. No matter how hard it is, you're living like a king. You're living like a queen, and you guys got everything. Like, no matter what happens tomorrow, you don't got to worry if you lose that something happening, you know? Like, you're not going to be sold to another gym. You're not going to be traded, you know?
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. I mean, I remember when I was in Thailand at Kasamrit, and, you know, you'd buy a pair of shorts and then you would like wash them or whatever after you'd done training, and then you hang them up. And then like the next day you'd go downstairs to get your shorts, and like the TIE fighters were just, some of the TIE fighters were using your shorts. And it was like, nah, and it was because like I would ask the guy and I'm like, oh man, he's using my shorts. And they're like, dude, because you just hung them there to get dry, like in the section where everyone hangs their shorts, and they don't give a shit, man. They just grab whatever they see. You know, like you see them and you see that, like they'll grab, the kids will grab like oversized shorts because they're just like, man, we just got to train. Like, that's all they know. And it's like, yeah, you got to.
How do you say that? I fought a guy from Koh Samrit.
Yeah.
One of their main fighters. And this is like one of their main guys, man. He sees me warming up in some shorts, before the fight, and he likes them, and I see like he gives me a thumbs up, and then after the fight, he comes to me, and then he points to my bag, his shorts, like, and he keeps giving me a thumbs up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's like? So I asked somebody, and they told me basically he likes my shorts.
Yeah.
And he wanted them basically. He's asking about them. Like,
yeah.
This guy is like, you know, he's fucking in Thailand. He's like one of the big fighters in his gym.
Yeah.
And he wants my shorts.
Yeah. You know,
so like I gave it to him, and I'm like, it's like I'm laughing at it now, but at the moment I was like I was sad for him. You know.
Yeah. No, and I remember that too. I mean, I remember when I left Kasamrit. One of the fighters that I kind of got along with, came to my room while I was packing, and it's funny, man, because like literally anything I was packing, like I had a Yankees cap, and he's like, "Oh, I like this hat. Can I have it?" And I'm like, "No," and then I was like, "No, dude, you know that's like one of my favorite caps, or whatever," and then like, I mean, bro, anything. You know, this belt is cool. Can I have it? You know, like stuff like that. And then you're like, damn, man, you know, you really get it. You know, like, I'm like, you know what? I gave him the Yankee cap. You know, I was like, fuck it, I can get another one. When is he going to get one? When is he going to get one like that? You know? And we're talking about, I mean, he wasn't like a well-known fighter, but he was, you know, he was a Thai fighter that had probably 100 fights already or something, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, you do see that. And it's crazy how much of a, like, you know, and we always hear those stories, and I remember Eric Haycraft, who's a friend of ours, saying to me, like, that he went to one of the gyms, and they'd be like, "You have a car back in the States?" And they're like, "Yeah." "You have a job back in the States?" And then he's like, "Yeah, I do." And they're like, "What the hell are you doing here?" You know?
Like, why are you doing it?
Exactly, you know, like.
Different way of life that people don't understand.
It's like they're doing it because they got to eat. They got to survive. As you said, you know, you give him a little bit of money and the first thing he thinks about is you know, giving it to his mom. I mean, I remember Yad Sinclair, if everybody remembers the contender Muay Thai, like when he won that money, like one of the first things he talked about was he wanted to build a house for his mom. That was what he was talking about the whole time. Like, that's what I'm fighting for, you know, and it's very different. And I'm and because you have that mindset, Rami, I mean, obviously we are going to know what your answer is going to be, but you know, we see a lot of that stuff here in the United States where it's almost like, you know, there's people dodging fights or trying to pick fights and, you know, all these things, you know, whether there might be 2-0 or 3-0 and they're putting their name out there, like there's some big name or big shot. And it's almost like, you know, you're like, they just don't know. They don't get it. You know, they don't get what this sport is about. But I think we're growing a lot, and there's a lot of the, now it's kind of like a lot of those people, you know, we talk about it, I would say, on this podcast all the time, where we're just like, people know those gyms now and know those people now, and they're kind of like, yeah, we don't, there's bigger promotions where they'll be like, yeah, we're not really interested in having him on the card or anything like that, you know, because they're known for pulling out or they're known for doing certain things. And because you got it, like at this point, a lot of people always talk about, like, especially if we talk about IFMA and USMF and everything like that, it's like you don't have, if you want to go and train, I mean, if you want to go and fight at that level and do well at that level, you don't have the, like you bring up that word, the luxury to be picking and choosing fights, man, because these guys over there aren't, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're fighting, and some of these guys, they live a tough life too in some of these countries, you know, Eastern Bloc countries and everything, where this is their life. Their life is, this is that, where they're, you know, they're earning money when they go to IFMA, and that's, like, for them can be a year if they win a gold medal, you know? So, you know,
it's in Iraq.
Yeah.
This is just Iraq. This is now a third world country after what has happened to them.
Yeah.
If a fighter from them wins an IFMA,
yeah,
he gets $700 every month for 10 years.
Oh, wow.
For 10 years.
Wow.
So when you see these fighters fighting like that, now you know why. You know, we get our fighters, you know, there's just no disrespect, but our fighters are not fighting to live. Like, those are fighters, the reason why you see them, they going out to kill somebody in the ring is because they're literally fighting to live. You know, that's their job. You know, imagine I tell you, hey, Vinny, Eric, you guys going to get paid, you know, $7,000 is like for us, probably like $3,000.
Yeah.
You're going to get paid $3,000 for the next 10 years. If you win this fight,
yeah,
Yeah. You're going to go out there and fight as hard as you can. Exactly. Man. Nothing's going to get in your way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different. It's different when that type of money's on the table. I mean, that's what they kind of like how they were talking about right now with that championship in one. You know, how like some of these guys, you know, all those upsets on the first night. It's like, yeah, it's different when you tell somebody there's $1 million on the table, especially these Thai guys, you know. So, yeah, man, that's crazy. So, I mean, I guess one of the things we want to bring up, obviously, is...
Well, actually, I want to go back to what we were talking about before.
Yeah.
You had mentioned fighting from 1982, and you said 2008. Did you... I'm pretty sure, I don't 100% know, that you stopped for a while, but then you fought again recently, a couple of years ago.
I never stopped. Right? Yeah,
you never stopped.
I fought every single year from 1992 till now. That's when I started training. And then my first fight actually is on YouTube. Not my first fight. It's my third fight. And it even says, you know, with the VHS, it tells you the year and everything. It tells you 1994.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. It's actually at that holiday, that same freaking Holiday Inn that I had that incident.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So what were you saying about 2008?
So you didn't. No, because those are the years that you mentioned before. So you didn't stop at all at any time?
I wish I did, but no, I never did.
what was your last fight?
Last year, 2018.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, April. It was literally the day before the USMTO in Arizona, and I had two fighters, two kids, two juniors who were not experienced fighting in USMTO, and I had just became the first unified Muay Thai world champion in America, from Philadelphia, and I didn't even celebrate or anything. A few hours later, I literally went to the airport and went to Arizona to go coach my two kids who were in the finals of the USMTO.
So you fought at least, you know, every year since 1992. What do you got planned for 2019?
For what's left of 2019.
So I told myself the only way I'd get back to fighting is if I start walking in the 150s. And I know myself. I would never walk in 150s. So that's my... So as of right now, my job, obviously I retired from my mom. She's the main reason I retired. Mm-hmm. So my job now, take care of my gym, take care of my fighters.
And travel the world.
Take care of, travel the world.
Yeah.
And help coach with the USA team. And now I got, I know you guys know I got my first newborn baby girl.
Yeah.
So having a wife and having your first baby is... It's a fight that I will never win.
Yeah. Hey, man, we're all there. We're all there, man. Yeah. You know, so
on top of that, my baby girl is a girl, so I'm like, God is paying me back.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's awesome. But so I guess what I wanted to go into is, obviously, since you've been, like we were talking about through this whole thing, you've been fighting since 92, training since 92, and you were saying, back in the day, nobody really knew what Muay Thai is. Now, it's even though it's still not a mainstream sport or anything like that, it's definitely in our community, in the community that we all have been involved in for quite some time now, it's huge compared to where it used to be before. And you're a big part of that in that sense, because you've been going to the, like you said, you just came back from the USF. Vinny was there as well. You're going to South Korea. You're going to the youth tournament in Turkey as well. That's coming up. I mean, you've been all over the place before as well, to a lot of different USMF in Thailand and other places as well. Tell me a little bit about how you think, that you, because I like your opinion on things is great, because of the fact that I feel like you look at things from a very realistic point of view, in the sense of, hey, we kind of do, and you said, like, no disrespect to the U.S. team, but in a lot of ways they fight in a different manner, or they're, the things that they have against them are in a different manner than some of these other countries, So how is it that, although we are getting better and we have better coaches and we have better understanding of these rule sets, how do you think the Muay Thai is going to change? How do you feel like we're going to fare or do get better and do well and better do better at these tournaments? And you know, we already did a pretty good job in the last one, you know, but how are we going to turn that into even higher to consistently medal, you know, maybe get, you know, get those gold medals and be a team to really be reckoned with, where, you know, now everyone's kind of afraid of the States, which is, you know, I don't think it's quite there yet, but they're getting there.
So, two answers. Mm-hmm. And this is the truth, man. And I don't care what any coach else can say, this is the truth. This is the only way USA will go. Mm-hmm. And the way it has been going is through our kids.
Yeah.
That's one. Mm-hmm. Two, you gotta fight. I don't know if you know, I'm pretty sure you guys know, but my fighters fight all the time.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes they walk week after week after week. I don't care about winning, losing. Because, like, no matter what I teach them, gym experience is not the same as ring experience. Mm-hmm. You want to get better, you want to be a fighter, you got to go and fight. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to get better. You got to fight. So we need to make sure our fighters fight as much as they can. And if they can't, then I'm sorry, you cannot represent something called the USA team.
Yeah.
Two, another way that we're going to grow is through our kids' program.
Mm-hmm.
That's, if you look at all the other countries that are medaling gold, there are fighters that's been fighting since they were kids.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, or they just fight a lot, you know what I mean? And that's the only way to compete. You cannot compete. I hope my fighters and your fighters are listening to this. If you are fighting four times a year, you are not going to beat anybody in this sport.
Mm-hmm.
If you are fighting six times a year, you're not going to beat anybody. I got one kid that fought five times in 5 weeks.
Yeah.
You know,
is that Kevin?
You go back, huh?
Was that Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I got another kid that's fighting five. He's a kid. He's only 17 years old. He fought five fights in 5 weeks. When you constantly fight that way, like, you're not afraid of fighting. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. No matter what, you're still going to have those nerves, but you're going to start getting comfortable in the ring. You're going to start, like, having that fire, you know, you never lose it. And then you remember your reactions, your everything, your timing is there. All that goes into play. The experience, you know, oh, this guy, he fixed the kick a lot. You're going to remember from the last fight, all that stuff. That's the only way to get better.
Yeah.
You got to fight. Minimum 10 fights a year. If you can't fight 10 fights a year, I'm sorry. You're not going to go anywhere. You think Muay Thai is not that big now? How you guys think it was in the early 90s?
Yeah.
I used to go to fights, and you could talk to some guy named Andy Russell. He's a very, you know, I don't want to say old man. He was a very wise man. He's been in the game longer than I could count. And he will. You could message him on Facebook and ask him. Did you used to see Rami in the 90s at events? He'll tell you, yeah. You're going to tell him, what did you used to see? He'll tell you, Rami used to go to these shows with a bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I used to go with a bucket ready. If anybody that pulls, I'm fighting. If anybody misses weight, I'm fighting.
Yeah.
Ask Aziz about this. There was one event. This was before I was with Aziz, before I was with Sitanjan. I was also still a kid. I was 16 years old. There was an event, and I think it was in Long Island. And the guy was, first of all, he was 30 years old. I was only like 16 years old. That didn't matter. Second of all, I think he was like 28, close to 30 pounds heavier than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, but I didn't care. Well, I knew he was like heavier. I thought he was like 5 or 10 pounds, not 28. But so Aziz found out, Aziz is not even my trainer.
Yeah.
He found out he was trying to cancel the fight. Why? Because the guy was that heavy. Like, I used to go and fight people that was heavier, older, more experienced, this, that. I used to fight pro fighters. And there's no sanctioning. There's nobody to stop these things from happening.
Yeah, I swear
to you, I used to have fights where I would, as soon as I'm done, before I start taking my stuff off, the promoter would come to me and he'd tell me, hey, listen, so-and-so, his opponent didn't come or missed weight. Do you want to fight them? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like now, you know, the fighters, they want to, you ask them, do you want to fight? Let me start training and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
It's like, if you, it's like a person who was looking for a job, you know what? Let me start thinking about what kind of job I want. And then I'm going to go, no, if you need a job, you're going to take any job to pay the bills.
Yeah.
So if you want to fight, you're going to take any fight to become a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
That's the secret. There's no other recipe.
Yeah.
You want to be somebody in there. I hope every fighter is listening. You want to be a fighter, you got to fight.
That's it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's that saying that we see a lot also on Facebook thrown around, which is fighters fight. You know, you can't, that's what they do. You can't, you know, be nitpicking or cherry picking.
It's not their fault.
Yeah.
You know, whose fault is it?
Trainers. Yeah.
I don't blame the child. I blame the mother. And that's the problem. You got a lot of trainers. That's the good thing. Yeah, Muay Thai is growing, but it's also growing because you got a lot of, I don't want to say nobodies, but you got a lot of people who are not intelligent.
Uneducated.
Gyms.
Yeah.
Uneducated.
Yeah, exactly.
And Michael Corley, I hope you're listening. You said this a few times. It's like just because you cooked for 30 years, that doesn't make you a chef.
Exactly.
You that's get what true. I mean?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, and that's the problem. You got a lot of people now opening Muay Thai gyms and, like, you know, they don't have the experience, you know?
Yeah.
It's one thing to open up a Muay Thai gym and you opening it for customers, you know? That's okay, good. But then you open up a Muay Thai gym, you don't have the experience and you want to coach fighters.
Yeah.
You know? Like, mm-hmm. I've been in the games for 28 years now. I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And
I still got a lot to learn.
Yeah, and I think that's important to mention.
People, they've been doing this for 10 years, 15 years, and they're opening up a Muay Thai gym.
Yeah.
What? No disrespect, but even if so, are you active? Are you doing something?
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if you're opening up a Muay Thai gym and you're coaching fighters, you're building them, this and that, and then you get people that they're not doing that stuff.
Yeah.
You got to go and make moves. Look at what Vinny's doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
How much has that opened your eyes when you went to IFMA?
We spoke about this on a podcast that we never released.
It was just bad.
So I don't think it ever will get released.
It will get released.
I was saying that not that it necessarily opened my eyes, because, you know, I've spoke to you. We spoke to everybody else who's been over there, been to the tournament. So I kind of, I knew what the level was going to be. I've watched IFMA fights. But it is a different experience to see it in person. You know, just to see the way everything.
Yeah, it's one thing, and then when you see it.
Yeah, just to see the way everything unfolds. You know, it's a whole different world. It's a different world. And one of the reasons I did go there is because education, and that's super important. And I am constantly, like you said, you've been doing this 28 years, you're still learning. I'm involved in Muay Thai about 15 years, I'm still learning. It's the people that feel they know it all, those are the people that are ruining the sport. If you're in this, I don't care if you're in this for 5 years and you open a gym, as long as you know there's still more for you to learn and you act on that, You can you know, be successful. That's the way I feel. Mm-hmm. It's all 100%. About continued education.
Yeah,
100%. You know, a fool thinks he knows everything, and a wise man knows he doesn't know enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Simple as that, bro. You could be in the game for 30 years. That don't mean nothing. You could be in the game, like you said, for 5 years. But if you're hungry and your drive is there to become better and learn, and you know, then you're going to go places.
Yeah, because there's that. It's that always learning, always, you know, always willing to open your eyes to maybe new things, you know, and new experiences. That's, I think, one of the things that I've always talked about too, or in my personal life, I always feel like, is you can never at any point think you know everything. You know, you have to continuously, and I always try to learn, like, from everybody that I meet, whether it's in my job, whether it's in Muay Thai, you know, I've had people that I meet and they're like just a little bit better than me at a few things, or really a lot better than me at a few things. And then I'm like,
he's talking about me.
And I'm like, I want to latch on to that person and really sort of, where can I improve my game, with that? What can I learn from these people? What can I learn from this person? And I've learned it. I learned it from bosses. I've learned it from, whether it's things with finances, whether it's things with what I do in my daily life, it's constantly, you have to have that open mindset. And I feel like there are so many times I've gone to tournaments or shit like that, where I see a coach that you kind of get in a conversation with them and you're like, this guy really thinks he is the man. And you're like, whoa, man, like I don't even want to continue this conversation, but let me just politely bow out, because this dude really thinks he knows everything, man.
God gave you one mouth,
yeah,
and two ears.
Exactly.
Which one are you supposed to use more?
Exactly. Yeah. Definitely, man. I love that. I love that. All right, man. Well, I know you're in your gym right now. We definitely don't want to keep you too long. So, Rami, like I always say, every time I see you, man, it's always great to see you. It's great to talk to you. We thank you for coming on the podcast. I think it was really, for a lot of people and a lot of fighters, great information about, about motivation, about discipline. I mean, guys, if you were listening to this podcast, this is a guy that I definitely stand behind, in the sense of the guy works his ass off. The guy really busts his ass to get his, get stuff done. One of the good guys in the game. One of the, I don't know, man, you're an inspirational dude. And, I've always thought you were a great person to listen to. You come up with you have some great, great stuff to talk about. And then not only that, man, like I always say, like everybody in the USMF always talks about, it's great to have Rami around, because he will motivate the hell out of you. So like for Team USA and everything, they love having you around, and it's awesome to have you on the podcast. So thanks for that.
Thank you to both of you gentlemen, Eric, Vinny. I appreciate you guys, what you're doing. It might seem like it's not. Sometimes you guys might be like, what the hell are we doing this for?
Yeah.
I appreciate you. A lot of people in the Muay Thai community appreciate you. And you guys are, this is, whether you've been told this or not, what you're doing is basically like a school. This is like a class. Mm-hmm. And people are going to class when they hear you guys speaking. So thank you to both of you for doing this.
Oh, man.
Appreciate those kind words, man.
Yeah, man. Definitely appreciate that. Yeah, we do have those thoughts every once in a while. Like, what are we doing? But, it's keeping the sport alive.
If you don't have those thoughts, yeah, you ain't trying hard enough.
Yeah. That's true.
I would sometimes wonder more why I'm doing it with Eric.
I knew he was going to bring that up, man. I knew he was going to bring that up. I just
that means that Eric is the guy. That means Eric is the one, man. That's what that means.
Yeah, man. But appreciate it. And like I said, good luck. Yeah.
So before we get going, Rami, let's have you give out some of your contact social media where people can find you if they want to.
Thanks, guys. So I'm on all of them. So Instagram, The Son of Palestine, Facebook, Rami Ibrahim, and Twitter, Rami Ibrahim. Just put Rami Ibrahim and you'll find me. Rami Ali.
Yeah.
I'm open to anybody, and I'm a very open guy to talk to anybody in the public, man. If anybody has any questions, feel free to message me anytime, DM me anytime, anything you might want to ask me. The only way to learn is to speak,
yeah,
and to get more knowledge. The wisest of us are those who go and seek knowledge. So I hope people go and seek knowledge.
All right, man. Thank you very much, man.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good night.
You too.
You too.
Muay Thai Khoo Chee Vit. All right, guys. So that was Rami Ibrahim. Like I said, obviously you guys can tell, big fan. He's a good dude. Awesome to talk to. Very inspirational. Freaking hard worker. So, if you guys hear that story, and you've heard a lot of the stories like that on our podcast, that are guys that are really just pushed through all the time, and any type of adversity, any type of, really any obstacles that a lot of us would probably in our regular daily lives, be like, you know, today I think I'm going to take a day off from training, or today I don't feel like it. That definitely doesn't happen with the guys at his level or his students or, you know, people that, like he was talking about, that really want to make it to be on Team USA. So, you know, it's important for up-and-coming fighters to listen to that type of stuff. You guys got to go out there and fight. You guys have to continue, you know, putting yourself out there and not, you know, not cherry-picking opponents and anything like that. You guys got to fight. Win or lose, that's what is important, especially when you're an amateur. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about, you know, your record right now or whether you're 7-0 at the amateur level. No one cares, man. No one cares. So just keep trucking away and fighting, and you'll get somewhere. So I think it's important, all the stuff that he brought up. And Vinny, you have anything to add?
I'm good.
You're good?
Yep.
All right. All right, guys. Well, with that said, with Vinny and his, you know, his basically monosyllabic responses, we'll basically head out now. As we had mentioned, you guys can always check us out on Striking Corner on Instagram, Striking Corner on Twitter, and on Facebook, Striking Corner as well. Strikingcorner.com is where everything is available, all the episodes. But of course, we are available on any podcast outlet you guys can think of, whether it's iHeartRadio, Spotify, iTunes, you know, wherever you guys want to find your podcasts, that is where we will be. So just look up the Striking Corner and find us there. Thank you for all your continued support. And if you are listening to us on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, please do not forget to leave us a rating and also a comment. It helps us rise up in the ranks there. And we want to continue doing this and continue putting out content and talking to some of the biggest names in Muay Thai, and keep the sport, as always, keep you informed about the sport and keep the sport alive and well in people's minds. So that is it. Thank you for all your support, guys, and we will talk again soon.
Wherever there is podcast, we are there.
You've been listening to The Striking Corner with Eric Rivera and Vinny Scotto.